Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, October 23rd, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline from today's paper is Biden, Trump in dead heat. Grinnell College polls likely voters in 2024 presidential election. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump would be in a dead heat among likely voters if the 2024 presidential election were held today, according to the latest Grinnell College national poll. Both Biden and Trump, running as their party's respective nominee, attract 40% support among likely voters. 18% say they would vote for someone else, according to the poll, conducted in collaboration with renowned Iowa pollster J. Ann Selzer. Support for both men splits along party lines, with 82% of Republicans saying they favor Trump and 83% of Democrats surveyed backing Biden. Independent voters remain divided, but tilt toward Trump, with 30% saying they would vote for someone else. We find President Biden and former President Trump are tied in a prospective 2024 race, but many voters aren't yet sold on either candidate, said Peter Hansen, director of the Grinnell College National Poll and associate professor of political science. Nearly one in five likely voters say they will vote for someone else. The size of this undecided group and its unpredictability adds a lot of uncertainty to the election outlook. A majority of those surveyed, 53%, also disapprove of Biden's job performance. On specific elements of the job, 36% approve of his handling of the economy, and 32% approve of his control over U.S. borders. On other issues, a plurality say they are less likely to favor candidates advocating a national abortion ban and are less likely to vote for those backing a ban on gender-affirming medical treatment for minors. 42% are more likely to vote for candidates on the side of forgiving student loans, and 41% support continued military aid to the Ukraine. A majority of respondents also said American democracy is under a major threat, a 5 percentage point increase from 2 years ago. A strong bipartisan majority also favors term limits for Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court. 59% support abolishing the Electoral College, and a 49% plurality also would do away with birthright citizenship. Burgum PAC spends $1.35 million. A super PAC backing presidential candidate Doug Burgum's bid for the Republican nomination is launching a new ad campaign in an effort to boost North Dakota's governor's standing among Republican voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states in the GOP nominating process. The Best of America PAC announced its plans to spend $1.35 million in television advertising and voter contact campaign to amplify Governor Burgum's message among Republican voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, and across the country. The campaign includes cable television ads, direct mail, and a direct text-to-voter program. We are making sure the people of Iowa, New Hampshire, and across America know that Governor Burgum is the conservative business leader and tech entrepreneur with the expertise and experience to turn America's economy around by putting his job creator experience to work for every American, Emily Benavides, Best of America PAC spokesperson said in a statement. Burgum failed to qualify for the third Republican presidential debate in Miami on November 8th. To participate, each candidate needs to satisfy fundraising and polling criteria set by the Republican National Committee. A Real Clear Politics rolling average shows Burgum polling at 1.8% in Iowa and less than 1% nationally. Women for Bohannon. A group of female Democratic members of Congress has endorsed Iowa City Democrat and former state lawmaker Christina Bohannon for Iowa's 1st Congressional District. Bohannon launched her second bid for Congress in mid-August, setting up a rematch against Iowa Republican incumbent U.S. Representative Miller Meeks. Iowa's 20-county first congressional district includes the cities of Davenport, Iowa City, Burlington, and Indianola. A law professor, former engineer, and mom, Christina knows the value of hard work. U.S. Representative Lois Frankel, a Florida Democrat and chair of Elect Democratic Women, said in a statement. As a state representative, Christina was a staunch advocate for women and families, fighting for reproductive freedom and affordable health care. Christina's unmatched work ethic will make her a powerful and effective leader in Congress. Elect Democratic Women was formed in 2018 by Democratic members of Congress with the purpose of electing more women to Congress. The next story from the front page is poll. Faith in U.S. institutions continues sliding downward, by Gary Fields and Lindley Anderson of the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. For many Americans, the Republican dysfunction that ground business in the U.S. House to a halt as two wars rage abroad and a budget crisis looms at home, is feeding into a longer-term pessimism about the country's core institutions. The lack of faith extends beyond Congress, with recent polls finding a loss of confidence or interest in institutions such as organized religion, policing, the Supreme Court, even banking. The GOP internal bickering that for nearly 3 weeks has left open the Speaker's position, second in line to the presidency, is widely seen as the latest indication of deep problems with the nation's bedrock institutions. "They're holding up the people's business because they're so dysfunctional," said Christopher Lauf, 57, a Democrat in Fargo, North Dakota. "Part of that business," he said, "is approving money for Ukraine to continue its fight against Russia's invasion, something he says ultimately helps the U.S., a point President Joe Biden stressed Thursday during an Oval Office address. "We're usually the knight in shining armor, but we can't be that now," Lauf said. "Trust in institutions has deteriorated substantially," said Kay Schulzman, a professor of political science at Boston College. She said she believes in government and the things it provides, such as national defense and access to health care, "but I also can very much understand why the American people can be cynical about government." The turmoil in the House and the federal case against Democratic Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who is facing charges for bribery, show that both major parties are contributing to the dour outlook. Right-wing Republicans pushed a member of their own party, Kevin McCarthy of California, out of the speaker job earlier this month. Attempts to replace him failed. "That is an example of exactly the kind of thing that I would say I can't foster trust of government among the American people. The multiple votes, the fractiousness within parties of people being personally ambitious and not being willing to compromise," Schulzman said. About half of adults, 53%, say they have, quote, "hardly any confidence at all," unquote, in the people running Congress, according to a poll from the Associated Press, NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, that was conducted in October. That's in line with 49% who said that in March. Just 3% have a great deal of confidence in Congress, virtually unchanged from March. About 4 in 10 adults, 39%, have hardly any confidence in the executive branch of the federal government, compared with 44% in March. Most Republicans, 56%, have low levels of confidence in the executive branch, which is overseen by a member of the opposing party, Democrat Joe Biden, compared with just 20% of Democrats. About a third of adults, 36%, say they have hardly any confidence in the conservative majority Supreme Court, a figure that remained steady in recent months. Democrats are more likely than Republicans to say their confidence in the Supreme Court is low. Black Americans are more likely than Americans overall, as well as more likely than white or Hispanic adults, to have hardly any confidence in the nation's highest court. One-third of U.S. adults, 33%, continue to have low levels of confidence in the Justice Department, with Republicans having less confidence than Democrats. This comes as former President Donald Trump rails against the department after being charged with mishandling classified documents and attempts to overturn the 2020 election results. Rick Cartelli, 63, a healthcare worker in Rocky Hill, Connecticut, who identifies as an independent, said he is happy with his local and state government, but the current environment wiped out what little confidence he had in Capitol Hill. "What is happening now is not good for the country at all," he said. Cartelli also said he has little confidence in the executive branch, citing what he calls Biden's mental lapses. Multiple AP NORC polls from earlier this year found the dearth of confidence is pervasive, spreading to other institutions. Slightly fewer than half, 45% of people, in a study from AP NORC and Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, said they have little or no confidence that the news media is reporting news fully, accurately, and fairly. Views on the U.S. military were best, with just 17% saying they have hardly any confidence in the armed forces. Kathleen Kersey, a 32-year-old healthcare worker in Brunswick, Georgia, who is a Republican, said she has little confidence in any of the federal entities, including Congress, but has more for the institutions closer to home. She is a fan of Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, who she said is a moral man. "There's only so much one person can do, and just with all the evil, it's hard to have confidence in anything, really, even the churches, because everything works together as one," she said. Confidence in the country's foundational institutions historically ebbed and flowed, though there's been a long-term downward trend since at least the 1970s. Trust in government waned in the early era of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers before making a slight recovery during Ronald Reagan's presidency in the 1980s. Turning to the Digest column, Russia missile strike on mail depot kills six. Kyiv, Ukraine is the dateline. A missile strike on a mail depot in the eastern city of Kharkiv killed six people, Ukrainian officials said Sunday, as Ukraine reported a record number of bomb attacks in the southern Kherson region. An additional 17 people were wounded in the blast late Saturday, which is believed to have been caused by a Russian S-300 rocket, Kharkiv Governor Ola Sinibahov said on social media. All of the victims were employees of private Ukrainian postal and courier service, Nova Poshta. Chinese vessels ram Philippines boat, Dateline Manila. A Chinese Coast Guard ship and an accompanying vessel rammed a Philippine Coast Guard ship and a military-run supply boat Sunday off a contested shoal, Philippine officials said, in an encounter that heightened fears of an armed conflict in the disputed South China Sea. A top Philippine security official told the Associated Press there were no injuries among the Filipino crew members, and an assessment of the damage to both vessels was underway. The official said that the two incidents near Second Thomas Shoal, where China has repeatedly tried to isolate a Philippine marine outpost, could have been worse if the vessels were not able to maneuver rapidly away from the Chinese ships. And briefly, earthquake. A 5.2 magnitude earthquake and some aftershocks damaged nearly two dozen houses in the hilly Dading district near Nepal's capital Sunday, an official said. The shaking also caused a landslide in the region, Hamnath Parfajol, a district government administrator said. Other details were not immediately available. Iran. A court in Iran sentenced two journalists to up to 7 years in prison for collaborating with the U.S. government and other charges, local reports said Sunday. Both women have been imprisoned for over a year following their coverage of the death of Mahsa Amini while in police custody in September of 2022. Turning to the sports page and the NFL roundup, QFG puts Falcons atop NFC South. Dateline Tampa, Florida. Young Ho Koo's third field goal of the game, a 51-yarder as time expired, bailed out Atlanta quarterback Desmond Ridder and gave the mistake-prone but now first-place Falcons a 1,613 victory over the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on Sunday. And excuse me on that, it's printed wrong, but now first-place Falcons a 16-13 victory over the Tampa Bay Buccaneers on Sunday. The Falcons snapped an 8-game road losing streak and moved atop the NFC South ahead of the Bucs, despite Ridder losing 3 fumbles inside Tampa Bay's red zone, including one that cost him a 12-yard touchdown run that would have put Atlanta up 10 points with less than 4 minutes to go. Ridder's fumble on a sack stopped the Falcons from breaking a 10-10 tie just before halftime. The young quarterback lost another fumble in the third quarter, one play after Drake London's 13-yard reception gave the Falcons a first down inside the Bucs' one. The receiver nearly scored on the play, although he appeared to lose possession as he stretched out for the goal line. The Bucs challenged the ruling on the field that London was down by contact before losing possession of the ball. Patriots 29, Bills 25. Mac Jones threw a 1-yard touchdown pass to Mike Gesicki with 12 seconds remaining to lift host New England over Buffalo, making Bill Belichick the third coach in NFL history with 300 regular season victories. Belichick joins Pro Football Hall of Famers Don Shula at 328 and George Halas at 318 as the only coaches to reach the milestone. Jones completed 25 of 30 passes for 272 yards and 2 touchdowns as the Patriots snapped a 3-game skid. Ravens 38, Lions 6. Lamar Jackson guided Baltimore to touchdowns on its first 4 possessions of a dominant first half, and the Ravens trounced visiting Detroit in a matchup of division leaders that was lopsided from the start. Bears 30, Raiders 12. Rookie Tyson Badgett led 3 touchdown drives. Deonta Foreman ran for 2 scores and caught a TD pass, and host Chicago beat Las Vegas. The Bears won for the second time in 3 games after dropping 14 in a row. Browns 39, Colts 38. Kareem Hunt scored on a 1-yard touchdown plunge with 15 seconds left, capping an 80-yard touchdown drive that gave Cleveland a road victory over Indianapolis. Seahawks 20, Cardinals 10. Kenneth Walker III rushed for a season-high 105 yards. Rookies Jackson Smith, Nagemba, and Jake Bobo both caught first-half touchdown passes, and host Seattle beat Arizona. Giants 14, Commanders 7. Tyrod Taylor threw 2 second-quarter touchdown passes, and the Dexter Lawrence-led Giants defense had 6 sacks and made a last-minute stand to help New York snap a 4-game skid with a home victory over Washington. Steelers 24, Rams 17. Jaylen Warren and Najee Harris rushed for touchdowns for the fourth quarter, and Pittsburgh awoke from a quiet offensive day just in time for a victory at Los Angeles. Broncos 19, Packers 17. P.J. Locke saved host Denver from another second-half meltdown, intercepting Jordan Love's deep pass in the closing minutes to preserve a victory over Green Bay. Chiefs 31, Chargers 17. Patrick Mahomes threw for 424 yards and 4 touchdowns. Travis Kelce caught 12 passes for 179 yards and a score. And host Kansas City Chiefs beat Los Angeles to take command of the AFC West. Eagles 31, Dolphins 17. Jalen Hurts rebounded from a pick 6 to hit A.J. Brown with the go-ahead touchdown on the next drive, and he threw for 279 yards and combined for 3 scores to lead Philadelphia over visiting Miami. Dolphins quarterback Tua Tagovailoa was 23 of 32 for 216 yards in his first head-to-head matchup against Hurts in the NFL. Hurts and Tagovailoa were teammates at Alabama. Brown finished with 10 catches for 134 yards. Now turning to the PGA Tour and the Zozo Championship. Morikawa wins for the first time in more than 2 years by Stephen Wade. Dateline, Inzai, Japan. American Colin Morikawa called winning the Zozo Championship in Japan incredible, a special way to close the season for a player whose great-grandparents emigrated from the country. But more important was a victory anywhere, any victory, after a 27-month winless streak on the PGA Tour that started prompting questions about his game. He broke through Sunday with a 7-under par 63 for a six-shot victory at the Narashino Country Club just outside Tokyo. "It feels so good, I can't even explain it," Morikawa said of his sixth PGA Tour win. "I knew I was going to get here at some point. It's like getting your first win, your first major." He said he realized that people were asking questions about why he had not won for so long. He said the victory was extra special since his wife, Catherine Zhu, was in the gallery and gave him a kiss when he came off number 18. "She hasn't been to a win since... it's been a long time since she's actually been at the tournament since we won, so it's nice to have her here," he said. Morikawa added that he hadn't done much to change his game, but acknowledged, "The thoughts in your head start piling up." He said that part of the challenge was not to overreact to losing. "I had to really look back and ask myself what's wrong," he said. "What's the reasoning behind finishing second? That versus a win. This means the world, being in Japan and being half Japanese." Americans Bo Hostler and Eric Cole were in second, six back with closing round 70s. Morikawa is clearly at home in Japan. He said he arrived last week with his wife and they began eating their way through the Japanese capital, everything from high-end to street food. "We spent 4 days, four full days, just eating," he said, "like, you know, visiting around, looking around Tokyo, but truly eating. We would eat at 7 to 8 spots. That's a lot." Though his connections are distant, local fans almost claim him as their own. He doesn't speak the language. His mother's roots are in Hong Kong, but he does carry a Japanese family name and an interest in learning more. "I knew at the beginning of the week that the fans out here are obviously rooting for the Japanese players," he said, "but I like to count myself as a part Japanese player, so I felt the love." Morikawa started two shots behind 54-hole leader Justin Suh, who faded badly looking for his first PGA Tour win. He finished with a 74. Morikawa had 4 birdies in the front 9, consistently hit fairways, which he didn't in the second and third round, and kept pulling away with 3 more on the back 9, including 1 from 10 feet on the 18th. "The putter got hot, which is really nice," he said. "I haven't had that in quite some time." Morikawa has been one of golf's most watched players, one of the game's best iron players, so even though he's had several chances to win recently, not getting it done has drawn some attention. His last PGA Tour title was the 2021 British Open. He also won the 2020 PGA Championship and followed it a few months later by becoming the first American to finish as the European Tour's number one player, taking the DP World Tour Championship. The only disappointment in 2021 was losing out in a playoff for a bronze medal at the Tokyo Olympics. Fellow American Sue had a one-stroke lead after 54 holes, but couldn't hold on. Now turning to LIV golf, Lahiri and DeChambeau carry crushers to team title. Dateline Doral, Florida. Anirban Lahiri shot a 7-under 65, and Bryson DeChambeau delivered the theatrics on the back 9 of the Blue Monster to lead the Crushers to a 2-shot victory over the Range Goats in the LIV Golf Team Championship Sunday at Trump Doral. The scores from all 4 players on every team counted in the final event of the LIV Golf's second season, and the Crushers were in control for almost all of the back 9 and led by 4 shots as the final group reached the 18th hole. DeChambeau made only 1 par on the back 9 and shot 67. Charles Howell III had a 72, and Paul Casey had a 73. Bubba Watson birdied the 18th for a 67 to lead the Range Goats. Taylor Gooch, who won the individual points title this season, and Thomas Peters each had 70. Harold Varner III shot 72. The range goats were still only two behind until Gooch put his tee shot on the 18th into the water, making bogey and leaving the crushers in a solid position. DeChambeau made his most remarkable birdie on the reachable 16th, which he hit long and left near the second green. He hit a high wedge over a concession area to about 18 feet and made the putt. Lahiri played bogey-free for the low round among the four teams playing for the title. "I was really pumped up," Lahiri said. "I had a couple of Sundays where I let myself down, and I wasn't going to let the team down today." The defending champion Four Aces never had a chance, with Dustin Johnson closing with a 75 and only one player, Peter Uihlein, with a 69, breaking 70. Now to Major League Baseball playoffs, American League Championship Series. Evaldi remains perfect. Dateline is Houston. Nathan Evaldi remained perfect this postseason, and Mitch Garver and Jonah Heim homered early before a ninth-inning grand slam by Adolis Garcia helped the Texas Rangers avoid elimination with a 9-2 win over the Houston Astros in Game 6 of the AL Championship Series on Sunday night. Evaldi, who also got the win in Game 2, yielded 5 hits and 2 runs in 6 and a third innings to improve to 4-0 with 2.42 ERA in the postseason game this year. The decisive Game 7 is Monday night in Houston, where the Rangers, one of 6 major league teams without a World Series title, need a win to return to the Fall Classic for the first time since back-to-back trips in 2010 and 2011. The defending World Series champion Astros were again felled by a subpar start from Framber Valdez and lackluster play at home. Valdez was charged with 5 hits and 3 runs with 6 strikeouts in 5 innings to fall 0-3 with a 9.0 ERA this postseason. The Rangers led by 2 before breaking the game open with a 5-run ninth, punctuated by the slam from Garcia, who struck out his previous 4 times up. The slugger was booed throughout the game after being at the center of a bench-clearing scuffle in Game 5 after being hit by a pitch from Brian Abreu. When Garcia knocked a pitch from Ryan Stanek into the Crawford boxes in left field with one out in the ninth, many of those fans began streaming for the exits after yet another poor home showing by Houston. The Astros, who are 5-0 on the road this postseason, won 3 in a row in Arlington, wearing their orange jerseys to move within a win of reaching their 3rd consecutive World Series. But it didn't help them carry their road magic home as they fell to 1-4 in Houston this postseason after posting a 39-42 mark at Minute Maid Park in the regular season. This series joins the 2019 World Series, which Houston lost to Washington, as the only best-of-7 series in postseason history in which the road team won the first 6 games. Houston led by 1 after a first-inning RBI single by Jordan Alvarez, but Garver tied it on his solo shot to start the 2nd. Heim connected off Valdez for the 2nd time this series with a 2-run shot with 2 outs in the 4th that put Texas on top 3-1. Houston got within 3-2 on a sacrifice fly by Mauricio Dubon in the 6th, but the Rangers got some insurance from an RBI double by Garver with 1 out in the 8th off Abreu. Abreu pitched the 8th inning for Houston after appealing the 2-game suspension he was given by MLB for intentionally throwing at Garcia. His hearing is scheduled for Monday. It's the first time the Rangers have won an elimination game in the postseason since Game 5 of the 2010 ALDS at Tampa Bay, when Cliff Lee pitched a complete game in a 5-1 Texas victory. They'd lost 5 straight such games, and Sunday's win was just their 2nd in 8 tries. The Astros had a shot to cut the lead late before Garcia's big swing, but Jose Leclerc came through after giving up the decisive 3-run homer to Jose Altuve in the ninth inning of Game 5. You just listened to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, October 23rd, 2023, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Next, we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger, and we will begin with the front page. Fort Dodge Apartments. Sunday blaze destroys the apartments. Eight families lose their home. No one injured. By Kelby Wingert. Eight families were displaced this weekend after an early morning fire destroyed most of an apartment building on Fort Dodge's west side on Sunday. According to the Fort Dodge Fire Department, a fire was reported at about 1:19 a.m. at 332 Avenue M West in the West Ridge townhomes. When fire crews arrived, they found occupants escaping the building with heavy fire conditions on the rear of Unit 332. A third alarm was called to bring additional fire department resources to the scene. Fire crews launched an aggressive attack along with search and rescue operations using three hose lines. According to the Fort Dodge Fire Department, the fire was brought under control at about 3 a.m., though crews remained to extinguish hotspots throughout the building until about 7:30 a.m. The apartment building contained eight units with 14 occupants and several pets. Five of the units suffered serious fire, smoke, and water damage. The remaining three units sustained smoke and water damage. No injuries were reported, and the Red Cross is assisting the occupants displaced by the fire. The cause of the fire is under investigation by the FDFD investigators, along with the State Fire Marshal's Investigation Office. Fort Dodge firefighters were assisted by the Fort Dodge Police Department and Mid-American Energy Company. The next story is also about firefighting. It's titled, Piece of Firefighting History Restored. Old Hose Reel Finds New Home by Bill Shea. The old hose reel, on its tall, spindly wheels, state-of-the-art fire equipment, when it first hit the streets in about 1879. It responded to its last fire call more than 100 years ago and largely disappeared from view. Today, following a full restoration job, it occupies a place of honor in the Fort Dodge Firehouse. It is a reminder of a time when hose reels like it were key to saving lives and property when fire broke out. Fire Chief Steve Hergenreder said it had been in storage at the Fort Museum in Frontier Village. He said he talked to Museum Director Tim Morris about it, and Morris said he saw the value of us taking it and restoring it. Continuing the story about the fire hose, it was moved to the firehouse at 1515 Central Avenue in the spring, where it sat in the garage behind some of the modern fire trucks. Hergenreder contacted Kurt Bacon, owner of Kurt Bacon Body Shop in Fort Dodge, to get his input on restoring the wooden and cast iron reel. He said Bacon volunteered his services to restore it. It was completely taken apart, and the individual pieces were taken to Bacon's shop. As Bacon finished each piece of it, these individual components were brought back to the firehouse. The hose reel was put back together about a month ago and was placed in the recently constructed new lobby of the firehouse. Anyone walking by the north side of the building can probably see its wheels through the windows. It consists of a reel around which a fire hose was wrapped, mounted horizontally between two tall wheels. Those wheels may have been in the late 1800s, but they still turn quickly and easily, as the firefighters discovered every time they had to move it. An axle and a large nozzle are mounted on its frame. A box on its front likely held spanner wrenches used to connect hose and additional nozzles. Hergenreder said it took at least four firefighters to pull it. There are no markings on the hose reel to show when it was built or who made it. And while there is no truly definitive proof that the wheel was used in Fort Dodge, Hergenreder found a photo from the late 1800s that apparently shows it in Fort Dodge. He said that prior to 1879, fires in Fort Dodge were put out by bucket brigades. In 1879, he said, Fort Dodge got its first water system when a pump station was built near the Des Moines River and water mains were extended up what is now First Avenue South, Central Avenue, and First Avenue North to about 12th Street. With those water mains came hydrants, he said. Firefighting could then be done with the steady stream of water under pressure through a hose line instead of buckets. This was a huge, huge change in firefighting in Fort Dodge in 1879, Hergenrader said. At about the same time, four volunteer fire companies were established to end the need for bucket brigades in Fort Dodge. Those volunteer units were the Wauconsa Hook and Ladder Company, W.A. Berry Hook and Ladder Company, Merchants Hose Company, and S.T. Meservey Engine and Hose Company No. 2. They operated from four firehouses across the city. Wauconsa Hook and Ladder is painted on the hose reel in honor of one of those old volunteer fire companies. The arrival of the city's first motorized fire truck in 1913 signaled the end for the old hose reel. Next is Warden Plaza and Pavilion on Fort Dodge Council Agenda by Bill Shea. A grant to help clean up the Warden Plaza and a move to add the development of a large sports pavilion at Corridor Plaza are on the agenda for the Fort Dodge City Council meeting this evening. The council meeting will begin at 5:30 p.m. with a workshop discussion on the application for it. $4.25 million grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. If awarded, the grant would help pay for removing asbestos and lead paint from the long vacant Warden Plaza at 908 First Avenue South. The city government once again took ownership of the building earlier this year in an attempt to find a developer to rejuvenate it. The council's regular business meeting will begin at 6 p.m. During that session, the elected officials will consider applying for the grant. The council will also consider adding part of Corridor Plaza to the Center City and Industrial Park urban renewal areas. Doing that would enable the city to use tax increment financing to aid the developer, M&M LLC of Ankeny. That firm has proposed a $13 million sports pavilion on the west side of the former Crossroads Mall property. It would house four basketball courts, three pickleball courts, and a microbrewery restaurant. On September 11th, the council voted to declare its intent to enter a development agreement with M&M LLC. The proposed terms of that agreement include the city providing $2.65 million from a bond issue next year, plus five annual payments of $275,000 beginning in 2026. Also Monday, the council will consider creating a new position of clubhouse manager at Lakeside Municipal Golf Course. The position would be paid for with revenue generated by the golf course, not tax dollars, according to a report to the council included with the meeting agenda. Domestic Violence Vigil is Thursday, is the next story by Kelby Wingert. The survivor of a horrific attack will share her story Thursday at a vigil to remember and honor domestic violence victims and survivors. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Locally, the Domestic Sexual Assault Outreach Center serves hundreds of domestic violence survivors in its 20-county coverage area. Between July 1, 2022 and June 30, 2023, DSAOC served 991 clients, including 591 in the emergency shelter, which totals 6,094 bed nights in the shelter. DSAOC also received 354 crisis calls during that time. To remember those who have been affected by or lost their lives due to domestic violence over the years, DSAOC is hosting its annual Domestic Violence Awareness Candlelight Vigil and Remembrance Ceremony on Thursday at St. Paul Lutheran Church. The vigil will start at 6 p.m. and is free and open to the public. The guest speaker will be Jennifer Schulke, a Grand Junction woman who was shot in the back of the head by an intimate partner in February of this year. She really should not be alive right now, said Marie Harvey, program director of the DSAOC's Homicide and Other Violent Crimes Program. She should not have survived. I think her story is very empowering. Shulkey has had a long road to recovery, and late this summer, her attacker was convicted of attempted murder. There will also be music, a reading of the names of those lost to domestic violence, and candle lighting during the vigil. Around the room will be red silhouettes of women, children, and men with a shield on each that tells the story of a domestic violence victim in the area. The vigil is a bittersweet event for family members of domestic violence victims, Harvey said. It gives them a place to memorialize their lost loved ones and share their memories. But it's also a reminder of how they lost those loved ones. It's a really sad event, but it's also so needed, Harvey said. They remember they're not alone, and I think it's kind of comforting to them. In Iowa, between January 1, 1995, and March 1, 2023, 385 men, women, and bystanders have been killed in domestic violence murders, according to data collected by the Iowa Attorney General's Office. Local businesses will have the opportunity to contribute to DSAOC's mission on Friday with Jeans Day. Lots of area businesses that typically have to dress business casual will participate and let their employees wear jeans if they donate $5 for DSAOC, said Program Development Director Lee Baer. In previous years, Jeans Day has raised between $2,000 and $3,000 for DSAOC. Checks can be mailed to DSAOC at P.O. Box 773, Fort Dodge, Iowa 50501. Every day, 20,000 calls are made to domestic violence hotlines across the country. Every minute, 20 people are physically abused by an intimate partner. Domestic violence affects people of all ages, all genders, races, and all socioeconomic backgrounds. Turning to the opinion page, support coats for kids. Effort provides winter gear for those who don't have any. It's hard to imagine facing an Iowa winter without a warm coat. Sadly, some area kids could be confronted with just that prospect if their families are facing a challenging economic situation. Fortunately, however, through the combined efforts of Shimcat Motor Company and the Community Health Center of Fort Dodge, many of these young folks will have warm coats and other winter wear as the colder, wintry days arrive. This joint project, called Coats for Kids, accepts donations of new and gently used winter coats, along with hats, scarves, mittens, and snow boots. All sizes are needed. Community members wishing to help can bring items to be donated to Shimcat Motor Company, 3126 Fifth Avenue South, Mineral City Mill and Grill at 2621 Fifth Avenue South, Papa Murphy's, 2813 Fifth Avenue South, and Starbucks, 2940 Fifth Avenue South. Cash donations are also accepted. Checks should be made out to the Community Health Center of Fort Dodge, 126 North 10th Street, Fort Dodge, Iowa, 50501. Coats for Kids should be written in the memo line so that the money is used to support that program. Money donations are used to purchase items for children that may be in short supply, such as certain sizes, after the clothing donations have been evaluated. The clothing will be distributed between 9 a.m. and noon, November 18th, at the health center. A drive-through system will be used so no one will have to find a parking space or get out of their vehicle. Shimcat Motor Company started the coat drive about 13 years ago. Because the effort grew very quickly, the car dealership teamed up with the Community Health Center about 9 years ago. The project has proved immensely successful. That first year alone, more than 1,000 coats were donated, according to Ed Shimcat Jr., co-owner of Shimcat Motors. The messenger applauds this worthy endeavor. We urge community members to give it the strongest possible support. Let's make sure that all our town's kids stay warm this winter. Turning to sports now, sports on TV. Major League Baseball, Arizona at Philadelphia, 4 p.m., TBS. Texas at Houston, 7 p.m., Fox and FS1. NFL football, San Francisco at Minnesota, 7:15 p.m., ABC and ESPN. NHL hockey, Montreal at Buffalo, 6 p.m., NHLN. Men's soccer, Premier League, Fulham at Tottenham, 2 p.m., USA. And the local calendar, volleyball, the Gales at AGWSR at 7 p.m. Now turning to professional football, this story is titled, Tight End U Takes Center Stage. Former Hawks Kittle and Hawkinson meet on Monday Night Football. Dateline, Minneapolis. The starting offense for the San Francisco 49ers offense was cycling through the narrated intros during a recent nationally televised game when a mischievous-looking face popped up on NBC's broadcast for his turn at telling the 26 million viewers where he learned his craft. George Kittle, Tight End University, was how this player, with the long blonde hair draping over his shoulder pads, confidently presented himself. Just in case Kittle's clever bit caused any confusion for the casual fans, he went to Iowa, the hard-nosed program that has proudly been producing NFL tight ends in the heartland of America, as well as any college team around. The Hawkeyes have practically built their scheme around the players at this long, underappreciated position that blends the flash and grit of the game as no other. My first day on campus, they told me if I didn't learn how to run block, I'd never touch the field. So I made it a passion of mine, said Kittle, who was a fifth-round draft pick by the 49ers in 2017. Iowa just kind of instills in you that you just have to work harder than everyone else, no matter what. When Kittle was a fifth-year senior with the Hawkeyes, T.J. Hawkinson was a wide-eyed redshirt in the tight end room. He wound up as the eighth overall pick in the 2019 draft by Detroit, which traded him to Minnesota last season. The two former Hawkeyes will be featured receivers for their teams on Monday night when the Vikings host the 49ers. They'll play heavy roles in the running game, too. There's not many schools that teach you to run off the ball like Iowa does, to go attack players, Hawkinson said. That was a big thing for me in college to learn that. Iowa tied for the most tight end alumni on NFL opening weekend rosters this year, matching Georgia, Notre Dame, and Stanford with five apiece. With Kittle, Hawkinson, Seattle's Noah Fant, and Lions rookie Sam Laporta, former Hawkeyes have a collective 94 catches for 1,014 yards and 8 touchdowns this season, entering Week 7 to make them the most productive tight ends from one school in the league. Iowa also holds that crown over the past 5 years, besting noted factories Miami, Notre Dame, and Stanford. It's just one of those places that really develop you. I wasn't really a star when I came out, said Hawkinson, an Iowa native whose first scholarship offer was from Iowa State, where his parents went. His brothers attended Iowa, though, and he long dreamed of playing for the Hawkeyes after growing up admiring their most accomplished former tight end, Dallas Clark, who accumulated 5,665 receiving yards over 11 years in the league. They've been a winning program for a long time, and that's an easy thing to buy into, Hawkinson said. Playing there definitely helped me through the ebbs and flows of the NFL system. Kittle and Hawkinson trained together in the offseason with some other NFL players at Kittle's 75-acre property outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Kittle and his wife installed a workout facility in a remodeled barn and had a football field built in the yard. The group brings in their own physical therapists and speed and strength specialists. Kittle and Kansas City Chiefs star Travis Kelce have also led an annual summer summit in the area called Tight End University for dozens of NFL tight ends to work on their games, help each other out, and have a good time. There's a lot to celebrate these days, thanks largely to Kittle. While wearing a microphone during a game in 2018, Kittle fawned on the sideline over a touchdown catch by teammate Garrett Celek and joked that he was National Tight Ends Day. Social media funsters ran with it, and the league caught on, and now the Day is observed each fourth Sunday in October. Got some family coming in, got some t-shirts made up, so I'm pretty excited, Hawkinson said. It's just great to be able to showcase what we do, because we do a lot. Next is Lynx Draw 3A Home Game by Dana Becker. For six area schools, the playoffs roll on this coming Friday night. Emmitsburg, West Bend Mallard, and Bishop Garrigan were all winners this past week to advance, with Webster City, Humboldt, and Algona joining them this coming week. The Lynx, 7-2 overall, secured an automatic bid in Class 3A with a win over Humboldt, allowing them a home game against Nevada, 7-2. Also in 3A, the Wildcats, 5-4, and Algona, 6-3, secured spots in the field. Humboldt travels to Williamsburg, while the Bulldogs are at Sioux Center. Emmitsburg welcomes Sumner Fredericksburg in a 1A tilt, while West Bend Mallard heads to Oneida CAM. Bishop Garrigan hosts defending state champion Remsen St. Mary's in 8-player action. The Wolverines and the Golden Bears, who were district rivals, are now paired in the same pod and would meet in the next round with wins. Next is UNI shuts out North Dakota, Dateline Cedar Falls. Theo Day threw for 2 touchdowns, and Amari Pisak-Hickson ran for 180 yards and scored a touchdown, and Northern Iowa dominated 9th-ranked FCS North Dakota 27-0 on Saturday. The last time the Fighting Hawks were shut out was September 18, 2021, when Drake beat them 38-0 in Grand Forks, North Dakota. Pisak-Hickson's 14-yard scoring run with 6 minutes left in the first quarter made it 7-0 and ended a 7-play, 65-yard drive that took almost 4 minutes. Pisak-Hickson finished with 31 carries. 8 minutes after Matthew Cook's 30-yard field goal, Day connected with Sergio Morance for a 70-yard score with 3 minutes and 40 seconds left before halftime. In the third, Day threw a 2-yard score to Brady McCullough and finished a 9-play, 75-yard scoring drive to seal it. Northern Iowa moved its record to 4-3, 3-1 Missouri Valley Football Conference, and have won 4 of its last 5. Tommy Schuster threw for 164 yards and an interception for North Dakota, which is 4-3 and 2-2. And we'll finish up with the Iowa Central Roundup. Tritons advance in regional play. The 10th-ranked Iowa Central women's soccer team posted a convincing 8-0 victory over Dakota County here Saturday in Region 11 tournament action at Rogers Sports Complex. The Tritons, 14-3 overall, now face Hawkeye back here on Tuesday in the semifinals at 2 p.m. The winner of that gets either number 5 Northeast or Iowa Lakes for the regional title this coming Saturday. During the regular season, Iowa Central picked up a 2-0 victory over Hawkeye at home. The Red Tails, 9-2-3, knocked off Southeastern to advance 3-1. Number 3, Iowa Central, bounces back. Following a loss to 2nd-ranked Cowley County on Friday, the number 3 Iowa Central volleyball team completed action here Saturday with a win over Metropolitan in 4 inside Hodges Fieldhouse. Scores were 25-17, 25-19, 25-22, and 25-20. Nomia Chiacchio had 19 kills, Emily Goodner recorded 11, and Araya Garrison 9 for the Tritons. Mercedes Madlock had 48 assists and 17 digs. Maya McLean had 33 digs and Alexis Harachara 14 digs. Olivia Sturgis added 6 kills with Madlock chipping in 4 and 17 digs. Iowa Central heads to Norfolk, Nebraska on Wednesday to face Northeast in its final ICC-AC match of the regular season. The Tritons are currently tied for the conference lead with number 5 Kirkwood and 12th-ranked Des Moines area. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, October 23rd, 2023. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access the recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.